to this episode of Sound Progress, the AXA IM podcast where we meet people driving progress on our climate commitments. By 2050, we aim to reach net zero across all our assets under management and our business operations. That has meant setting some bold ambitions for targets for ourselves and transparently reporting against them each year. One of those targets is our mission to exit coal from OECD countries by 2030 and from the rest of the world by 2040. But just quitting coal isn't as easy as it sounds, nor is it necessarily responsible to simply divest from coal-exposed assets overnight. Today, we're exploring why that is and what the future holds for investors in the energy transition. To help me explore this topic is Chief Energy Economist at the International Energy Agency, or the IEA, Tim Gold. Hi, Tim.
Hi there, Herschel. Great to join you.
Thank you. The Head of Climate and ESG Research at AXA IM, Olivia Eugene.
Hello, Herschel. Happy to be back again in the podcast.
Thank you for coming back. And AXA IM's Head of Infrastructure, Mark Gilligan.
Hello, Herschel. Hello, Tim. Hi, Olivia.
Great to have everybody here with us. So, as is now typical, we start off with an icebreaker. So, given we're talking today about the difficulties in quitting coal, I wanted to start by asking you all, what is the most difficult thing you've had to leave or quit in your lives? Tim, do you want to kick us off?
Well, it's a tough one. I found it tough, to be honest, to give up playing football. I used to play regularly in Saturday leagues, not at any sort of high level. But there was a moment when my body and, to be honest, my teammates were telling me it was time.
Mark?
That's a great question. I think giving up television was probably the hardest thing to do, but I feel much better now that I've done it.
Olivia?
Well, I've thought of two answers. One, more trivial, is stopping beating my nails when I was a teenager. It was not that easy at all. And after, I used to read science fiction book until one or two in the night. And at some point, I could not continue because my body was betraying me in the next day. So I had to stop reading that late.
Excellent. For me, the hardest bit has been quitting caffeine. So I was a heavy caffeine drinker, coffee and tea. And I've now regimented myself to having not more than 2 cups a day. I fail sometimes, but on average, I've hit my mark. But it takes a bit of personal will to do. And speaking of personal will, I think this is going to be quite an exciting discussion because there are both economic and social challenges that we have to deal with when we come in quitting coal. Tim, perhaps we could start with you to give us a bit of the bigger picture of how much of the world's energy is currently coming from coal and the difference between OECD and rest of the world. And what does that mean for CO2 emissions?
I think there's a narrative that you'll sometimes hear that coal is gone, coal is in decline. That's not the case. Coal demand, far from declining, has been hovering around near record levels for the past decade and reached a high point last year. So it's still a big part of the energy that we use worldwide. It's second only to oil in the global energy mix. But more so than for any other fuel, there are big regional variations in how it's used. So 80% of all coal use worldwide is in emerging and developing economies. And China alone accounts for over half of global coal demand. So you have that immense concentration in use in certain parts of the world that are highly dependent on coal. And that also affects the politics of the discussion around coal. Because in a sense, focusing on coal as the main source of global CO2 emissions, and it certainly is that, it doesn't feel like a neutral choice if you're in one of those economies. It feels like a choice that is directed at certain countries. And so I think that's something that we need to be aware of when we talk about bringing down emissions from coal, which we absolutely have to do. We have to frame that as part of a much broader drive to reduce all sources of emissions worldwide.
And linked to that, the IEA has explicitly called for no new oil, gas or coal developments in the world to reach net zero by 2050. How does the IEA propose that that's going to be achieved?
So when we think about this big global transformation, you know, the thing we start from is not emissions as such. It's about the services that energy provides, you know, the heat, the light, the mobility, the things that we need for our lives. And so the crucial question that you have to answer when you think about reducing the use of coal is, what are you going to replace that coal with? How are you going to meet the energy services that coal currently provides with other sources? And that is much easier to talk about for power than it is in other sectors. So power is currently about 2/3 of global coal use, and we have mature, ready-to-go, competitive, clean energy technologies that can be ramped up and can substitute for coal in many parts of the world. There is also 1/3 of coal use comes from industry, and there it's a slightly different picture. We don't have the same sort of ready for the big time technologies that can step in and replace coal. So the key word, I think, when we come to that industrial coal use is continued innovation. We need to get some of those new ways of meeting industrial coal demand into the system at scale. But when it comes to power, I think we know the solutions, but the task is to scale them up and scale them up very quickly indeed.
And one of the common things that happens when scaling up is talked about is private investment. Mark, perhaps I can get you in as head of infrastructure for AXA IM. Any views on how we can encourage private investment into this challenge?
Look, I don't think any more encouragement is needed. You know, we've seen significant subsidies support the rapid improvement and driving down of costs for wind and solar over the course of the last 15 years to the point where today, they are, you know, some of the cheapest sources of electricity on the planet. If we look at, say, solar photovoltaic costs over the course of the last decade, you know, in 2010, Imperial College thought it would take 90 years for cost to come down by, 85% or thereabouts. It took less than 10. And so we have seen the emergence of levelized costs of energy for solar PV, so photovoltaic, as well as onshore wind and now offshore wind, becoming the most competitive sources of electricity on the planet. So in terms of support phase, I think that's largely over in the developed world. And we're now entering the simple process of scaling up. And so the technologies, the financial technologies already exist. You know, you have big one-off wind farms that are there being built by major utilities and then sold down to financial investors, right? We're seeing a real proliferation of independent power producers. So newly emergent utilities that focus on just wind and solar, that are vertically integrated, have the capacity to develop, construct, finance, operate, and trade ultimately electricity generated. So the debate is really around finding opportunities for more capital to flow into emerging markets to support that work. I don't want to imply that it's easy, right? It is a massive challenge. But back to Tim's point on the generation side, that war is already won technologically. It's really around the rollout and then managing the social and political consequences of a just transition, right? And which brings us back to the central discussion point here. Is it possible to have an instantaneous transition? No, it's not. And so we need to be able to manage the competing politics and claims for capital that will inevitably be part of the public debate and discourse over the next 25 years.
Absolutely. And I think that's going to be the hardest challenge where even politics will adjust to new opportunities that are coming up. Olivier, perhaps I can get you in because one of those challenges around navigating is about engagement. And I know that AXA IM updated its climate risk policy and announced its ambition to exit coal from OECD countries. Could you explain what that means and how that's going to work?
Yes, absolutely. Rebounding on what Tim and Mark said, we have a coal policy that is harsh because it's not justifiable to have coal assets, especially in developing economies. As it was explained, there are better ways to produce electricity than coal. They are better for the environment and they are better economically. And as Mark said, the technology battle is over. It's very clear. So we are harsh. We're especially harsh for OECD countries because they're wealthier. They have a greater ability to convert their power system. You have a few Western world countries where coal is still large and you may have issues. I'm thinking Poland, a bit Germany, somewhat the US. Even coal was half of the power mix in the US 20, 25 years ago. Now it's below 20%, so it's happening. When I say harsh, that's what you said, no coal, 0% coal for OECD-based companies by 2030. And zero means zero. Even if you're an electric producer somewhere in OECD and it's 0.1% of your power mix, we have to divest. We cannot invest in this company. So what does it mean for engagement? Today, the threshold we have is 15% of revenues or 15% of power production from coal. If you're above that, we cannot have the companies in our portfolios. So we have to go from 15 to zero. A year ago, the threshold was 30%. So we've tightened the screws. And we've said that it will be 10% in 2026. So we went from 30 to 15, soon 10, and then zero. Companies that are below the thresholds, we can invest in them. And very clearly, we make sure also if they're OECD companies that they have a strategy to exit coal by 2030. I could give a number of examples like this. In Europe, companies like Engie or Enel still have a tiny bit of coal and have commitments to close their facilities or convert them to another fuel by 2027, 2028. We have a case of a company in the US called Xcel Energy. Today, they're above our thresholds, so above 15%, but they have given a very detailed plan to be at zero in 2030 with a plan, plant by plant. And we're talking about 15 power plants that have to be closed, mostly closed, and a few of them converted to natural gas. So we've decided that we could invest in them because they give the right spirit. Where it's very challenging, it's in Asia. When you have countries where coal is 2/3 or 3/4 of power of the power mix, the average utility is way above our threshold, and it's going to be very difficult for them to go below the threshold and to zero coal. Most of those countries are not OECD, so it's for 2040, but that's a difficult transition.
When these companies are doing shutting down of power plants, how are they managing the social impact of that?
It's really a case by case and an almost side by side situation. It's going also to depend on local regulation. I mean, social policies are very different in Europe than in North America. It depends also whether it's a closure, a plant closure, or the conversion of a plant to something else. A number of coal plants have been converted to biomass or to natural gas. So you still need staff. The challenge is, do you need the same quantity or the same number of people? Is the skill base the same? And what about local communities? Because usually when you close a coal power plant, you have an impact on coal mining as well. So how do you train the staff? How do you make sure that the local community is in good health, is kept alive? And so side by side, locally, it's going to be different. And it has to be done with all the stakeholders, the trade unions, the local politicians, the local regulators.
Mark and Tim, any views on that?
Maybe I can add a couple of elements of perspective on the scale of the issue, because you know there's around 9,000 coal-fired power plants in operation today. And if you put those together with the industrial plants that use coal around the world, and you assume sort of normal lifetimes for all of this, then you know that gets you already over the 1.5 degree limit. So something needs to change. And the complicating factor, and people have hinted about this as well, is that when we look at OECD markets, most of these coal plants are old. The average age in Europe or in North America is over 40 years for a coal plant. But in Asia, we're talking about teenagers. We're talking about an average age of between 10 and 15 years. And that means that under normal circumstances, these plants have a lot of time left to run. And they also have a lot of unrecovered capital. In our view, probably more than $1 trillion worth of capital is yet to be recovered by the investors in those plants. And that's a political problem, frankly, because you can imagine that those asset owners are also, they have a voice within their respective systems. And so that acts as a counterweight to some of the things that we're talking about. So there are certainly complications, and favorable economics on their own are not going to manage this in time, and they're not going to manage it effectively. So there do need to be specific policies in place, both for the managed sort of decline of these assets, and not all of them have to be shut down. There are roles in our scenarios for plants that run at very low utilization rates, but also run flexibly to compensate for, you know, the variability of some other elements of the system. But it is incredibly important to get that right also from a social perspective.
Wow. And we focused a lot on coal and power generation. I wanted to also spend some time on the other aspect, which I think Tim mentioned as one third in terms of coal use and heavy industries like steel or cement. What does the future look like for them?
There we have to take a slightly different tack. I mean, there are elements there where we certainly know well how to scale up alternatives to coal, particularly where it's used for relatively low temperature heat. There are multiple options now emerging, including direct electrification, but also heat pumps that can provide some of those services very cost effectively. But the difficulty comes when you look at large-scale coal use in the iron and steel industry, in chemicals, in cement. And there we have to look at a range of other technologies, including, in some cases, capturing the CO2 emissions, but also some of the new emerging alternatives like hydrogen-based steel production, which would allow for a different way of thinking about bringing those much-needed commodities into our lives that don't have the same implications for emissions. But there are some promising demonstration projects, including ones in Europe. But I don't think we're ready to say yet that we have all of the answers there. We certainly don't have all the answers in a very cost-competitive way. So we need continued support from governments. We need continued efforts to innovate and work out ways to bring those costs down so that we have, you know, competitive alternatives to coal there. And that's particularly important for emerging and developing economies that are going to see this huge build out of infrastructure, big increases in urban populations. That's where we're going to need that steel, that cement to build up all of the aspects of modern infrastructure for people's lives.
And if you want to know more about cement, listen to our first episode, because we had a few people from the industry talk about some of the challenges that industry is facing as well. I want to also ask the final piece of the puzzle, which is about regulation. And what are some of the regulatory challenges that are facing energy companies that are looking to exit coal? Olivier, do you want to kick us off?
Yes, I'd like to start with a piece of news I saw the other day in my daily routine from Australia, the state of New South Wales. The regulator asked Origin Energy, a large electric utility, to delay the closure of the coal plant. A 2.8 gigawatt coal plant. So it's a very, very large facility. In the greater scheme of electric generation, that's big. The plant is supposed to close in 2025, and it was going to be delayed. The reason of the delay is that alternative supply for electricity are not being developed fast enough. So the regulator is worried that the market will be tight and there could be shortages. So regulators are increasingly a role to play in decarbonation, but they also have a role to play in ensuring supply.
Mark, any views on that?
One of the things we talk about when we're talking about investing is that it's really important to embrace the complexity of the energy transition. It's not enough to sit back and say, we are going to be perfect instantaneously by only owning wind and solar farms. We want to buy those companies that do have 40% exposure to gas-fired generation, or a fleet of ferries or buses that are diesel-powered, partly, because we know that under our ownership, we can phase out that aging equipment and replace it with electrified equipment. And so one of the key opportunities we see is being able to embrace that marginal zone and help accelerate things down those paths. But to what Tim and Olivier have just said, the critical thing is about policy and a give and take and a recognition that there are no easy answers to these things. People need to be comfortable with ambiguity and trade-offs as long as they have the longer-term goal agreed. And that's, you know, getting to net zero, or in parallel getting to no more than 1.5 degrees, or what seems more likely to by 2050.
Excellent. We're coming to the end of our podcast, so perhaps we end on a sign of hope. And I can ask each one of you to give me something that inspires you about this challenge, something that gives you hope that we will reach the goals.
The thing that gives me optimism in general about the challenge of transitions is the fact that for most of the things that we need to do, we know the tools. We have tried and tested ways to make this work. It's really a question of scale, of really finding ways to bring these cost-competitive technologies into the market and the infrastructure that supports them at a speed that we've not seen up until now. So we know how to do this. We know how to do the lion's share of what needs to be done to get us to net zero. But I think we need to come back to, put yourselves in the shoes of an emerging or developing country policymaker. They will not take steps that they feel come at the expense of their energy security or of their development prospects. So we need to be very aware of the positive side of that in terms of the opportunities for economic growth and sustainable growth that come with clean energy transitions. We can't just talk about moving coal out of the system.
Olivier?
My full-time job over the past 2.5 years is looking at the energy transition. Probably I've become a bit more pessimistic than I was before doing this. But if I think in terms of inspiration, I believe one point that Mark made that is essential to me is that the transition is complex. Because we're not talking about having less oil, less coal, and less gas. We're talking about fully changing the industrial ecosystem. Because it's not about just the supply of fossil fuels. It's about the demand and changing all the technologies, the behaviors, and to a large extent, social norms. What I find inspiring in this is what can I do internally within AXA IM is to try to convey this analytical framework. It's not just about saying this company is bad, this product is bad, but showing that it's a broad ecosystem change where everything is interconnected. And we need education and awareness if we want to change and move.
Thanks, Olivier. Mark?
Look, I'm a very fortunate man. I get to invest in infrastructure across digital, energy, social, transportation, and utility infrastructure on behalf of my clients, both within AXA Group and beyond. And when I start a new meeting with a prospective client, the very first page we open is one that just says, climate change is the great issue of this century and the central risk of tomorrow. Right? I start every meeting with that page, and whether it's in London or Stockholm or Tokyo or Toronto, when I'm talking to institutional clients that are looking to invest into infrastructure, overwhelmingly they nod. Right? So my cause for optimism is that debate is already over in sensible investment houses. People are already recognizing that's the main game, and they want to make sure that their portfolios are not just aligned with some headlines that make attractive headlines when they talk to, you know, people behind them, right? In terms of greenwashing, they recognize this as being fundamental to protecting their own interests in the long run. And so I think, although Olivier can quite rightly have days of being pessimistic, there is cause for optimism. And I think that we've got about 80% of the problem solved, and so we should get on with it and then focus our attention in investing into that last 20% of hard-to-solve problems.
Thank you so much, Olivier, Tim, Mark. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ashok.
Thanks very much, Ashok. Thanks, colleagues.
And thank you so much for our listeners. I hope you got a good sense of some of the challenges that exiting coal faces. Olivier references AXA IM's coal policy in this episode. For full details, please see our climate risks policy on our corporate website, www.axa-im.com/r-policies-and-reports. Links are in the description. And next time, we'll be talking about transition minerals and the hidden cost of clean energy. Thank you so much for listening. Take care of yourself, and if you can, of the planet too. This marketing communication does not constitute, on the part of AXA Investment Managers, a solicitation or investment, legal or tax advice. This material does not contain sufficient information to support an investment decision. The value of your investment can fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested. Past performance is not a guide to future performance. Please see the website www.axa-im.com/soundprogress for full disclaimer.